I had some advisor, and I said, look, I'm not prepared on this stuff. What happens if I flunk these exams? He said, well, I guess we'll just have to throw you out.
A true inspirer.
And after I'd been at MIT for a very short time, I was offered an optics job. It was a very high level optics job. I was very flattered and looked at it very briefly. But
who with?
This was a company in Ohio that was working on some kind of bomb sites or gun sites.
Mm-hmm.
And I was flattered, you know. I didn't have very high aspirations for a salary, but they were going to pay me what I was expecting to get when I got out of school. So I thought about it, but I went more out of curiosity to be flattered, and
mm-hmm.
and didn't, of course, didn't follow through on it.
And that was quite early on while you were there.
Yeah, I'd been there 4 or 5 months or something.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Something like that.
Did you have any acquaintance then at this time? I guess Perkin Elmer was also big in optics at that time.
Yeah.
And
Perkin Elmer. And those were the big companies. And I had my first interaction with Beckman, who had made a spectrophotometer that was a little beyond their capabilities, as it turned out.
This was the IR-3,
yeah.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was really, one of their very first commercial spectrophotometers,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Infrared, I guess.
Yeah, infrared. Yeah. And it turned out that barium titanate, the material I was working with,
mm-hmm.
had some very unusual structural changes when it became ferroelectric.
Yes.
The barium went off center, but this was turned out to be almost impossible to detect by X-rays. For some reason it didn't work. So I investigated how barium titanate went through its structural changes by looking at changes in the infrared absorption spectrum.
Right.
And which I found pretty interesting.
And that was that IR-3 instrument already in the laboratory?
No,
or did you acquire
that? Alton Galeo ordered it, and he left just about the time it arrived. So I was stuck there with this big thing that didn't work. And
it didn't work
well. It didn't work well at all.
Hmm.
And so I, raised quite a fuss about it, the lack of technical support from Beckman, and von Hippel got a hold of Beckman, and they sent Beckman engineers, and so by the time I was done with schooling, all the top people in Beckman knew me.
As the problem maker with the IR-3?
As a problem solver for the IR-3.
Did you suggest some design changes that they made, or?
Well, I suggested some minor, more operating procedures than basic design changes.
Right.
And but I used it, and by the time I was done, it was working pretty well.
What was the main problem with it? I'm curious.
It was mainly electronics that weren't working.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And they had some sort of a recorder in it with a magnetic wire recorder rather than a tape recorder.
Oh.
And that didn't work. None of the stuff worked terribly well.
And had you had any people had looked at these materials using the X-ray diffraction and hadn't been able to get good results? And was it your idea to bring the infrared spectroscopy there?
That was von Hippel's or Galeo's idea,
right.
that this was a way to investigate these materials.
Had you had any previous experience with spectroscopy?
No. I took courses at Rochester dealing with the not infrared work, which was a fairly new area. But I could pick it up without any trouble.
Did you enjoy it at all?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I liked my graduate research. The coursework was, as I look back on it, I didn't take that many formal courses. I took quantum mechanics the whole way through. I had to take a minor in math, so I took as many math courses as physics courses. As I said, I had no love for nuclear physics. I was right in the heart of solid state physics, and so when it came time for my doctoral exams, quantum mechanics was a requirement, and then I could pick a minor, not another area. And if I'd done it in optics, I could have. I knew more optics than anybody at MIT probably. But I said no. I'm setting out to be a solid state physicist, so take it in solid state physics, which was about. So for about 6 or 8 months, I just learned solid state physics on my own. The first book that came out was Cattell's book, first journal book. That was after I was out of school, so I just had to read journal articles and sort of figure out. It was a great voyage of discovery.
Had Seitz written?
Yeah, Seitz had written his book, and Slater that I took courses from.
Oh, wow.
So I had, Slater was a marvelous lecturer. So I had Weisskopf for quantum mechanics and Slater for
not too shabby.
No. So that, you just get into one humorous anecdote about the Weisskopf, who was a great theorist, but not the world's best mathematician, which he was the first to admit. I had a visitor there. We had a Saturday course in there, and I said, "Well, come on, sit in." Visitor from Princeton. I said, "Come in and sit and hear a real pro give a lecture." So we went in there, and Weisskopf started out and filled the whole board, kept going and going and getting more and more confused, and he finally said, "Well, this was elementary quantum mechanics." And he finally said, "Look, I'm so confused, it doesn't make any sense for me to continue. Let's just quit right now." But he was a marvelous human being. He's just one of the greats. Very inspirational.
To you personally?
Well, no, just the physics community in general. The way he turned into a leader and explaining physics to the world, and how I think the title of one of his books was "The Joy of Being a Physicist."
Yes.
And I found that a very great experience.
Now, I think I did see at one point that you held an IBM fellowship. Is that correct? What was the story of that?
IBM could see the potential of ferroelectrics.
Oh, right.
And so they wanted to sponsor my work. And MIT said, you can't pick people that we give fellowships to. You have to just send us some money and have us do it. They really wanted to sponsor my work, so they narrowed it the IBM Fellowship in Ferroelectric Material Investigation. I was the only one working on that, so I got it.
And was there anyone in particular from the IBM side that used this fellowship as a way to get into a dialogue with you?
Oh, yeah. They'd fly me over to Poughkeepsie on their company plane once in a while, and I'd talk to them about one thing or another. And they had hired a fellow that preceded me at von Hippel's lab, who was at there, so he was the one who was sort of mm-hmm. instrumental in this. And when I got out of school, I was talking to him. He said, Jay, I know you pretty well, and the sort of regimented environment here is one I don't think you would work well in.
Hmm. And this is before they started their, or must have been just around the time they started their research laboratory? No, it must have been before they had.
It was, I don't know how things were organized there, but it was, strict dress code,
right.
Punching a time clock. He told me an incident where somebody was objecting strongly to, having come from an academic background, mm-hmm. but punching a time clock, and his boss kept saying, "Well." It's nothing bad about punching. They said, as a matter of fact, I sort of like it. And the guy turned to him and said, if you like it so much, you can punch my goddamn clock from now on and quit and walk out. This is a story that Young had told me. He said, this is the sort of thing you're going to be faced with here. So I didn't even apply for a job.
Mm. Although it sounds like they would have been very... if they wanted to start an internal program, mm-hmm. that would have been...
Well, ferroelectrics, lost out to the magnetic materials in the memory area, so it never did realize its potential. There's always a lot of really interesting possibilities, none of which ever worked out.
Mm.
It was always too expensive to compete with other things. Part of the problem.
But this was still in a... Had the magnetic core memories, I guess?
Von Hippel was making some of those magnetic core materials.
Because that was an MIT invention, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah. And again, it was an interdisciplinary thing. You've got Jay Forrester and that bunch who were interested in it.
Right.
So it was a great tie-in and all those things.
Did you become acquainted at all during these days with what was happening in computing? Since your research was connected to
No, I didn't. And the transistor was not in sight yet.
Mm.
It was, but it didn't show up in anything I was reading or that I knew anything about.
Right. So during the summers, then you were by and large doing what?
I was just doing what I always have. I may have taken a summer course or something mm-hmm. like that. I had to learn French. And
were you returning to work in Preston's laboratory?
No, I had stopped when I got out of school.
Right,
I may have. On a few vacations, gone out there and helped out with one thing or another
mm-hmm.
for a week or two, but nothing very major. It was a full time job.
I'm sure.
At MIT, so there wasn't any division.
Right. And did you find time again in a very rigorous, academic program? Did you find time for many extracurricular activities?
No.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
I did read one somewhere that that indicated that your real interest in abstract art sort of developed in this time period while you were in graduate school.
Yeah, I always had been in. I've never had much exposure to art, but I think it was tied in with optics and the perfection of crystals, and I've always to this day been interested in abstract are abstract forms. I always walk around here, you'll see a lot of mineral specimens and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So my interest in art has always been toward the simple abstract forms. And so when I, with MIT, would go to the Physical Society meetings, I'd go to the Museum of Modern Art and see all this wonderful stuff and took an instant liking to it.
Mm. And but did you start to recognize that as a real interest in yourself at this time?
No, it's something that I liked looking at.
Right.
And I never thought of collecting it, of course. And but, so. But I found Boston, as I said, a very stimulating town.
Sure.
But I realized that while it was fun to observe this bizarre political process as a student, as an outside student, I didn't think I wanted to spend my life raising a family in this Massachusetts corrupt political environment.
Right.
So I didn't especially want, I made a conscious effort not to stay in Massachusetts.
Hmm. Well, so so in thinking about these infrared studies that you were doing for your dissertation research, how did that, once you had sort of settled your research topic, you know, your problem, what was your experience like with the unfolding of that research? Was it fairly smooth, or?
Well, it sailed along. The hardest part was I realized that while these materials were semi-transparent to infrared, it took a extremely thin crystal to get enough light through.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody had ever made a crystal this thin.
Oh.
And it was so thin, when I got it, I developed etching techniques where I could watch the thickness by absorption bands.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got down to the last band, it would be thin enough. And I went through an awful lot of crystals. I was etching this phosphoric acid, and I realized I had to put my hands in this stuff in order to manipulate stuff, so my fingers had some sort of a black, crummy appearance, scaly fingers. But I did, and the crystal was so thin by then. This is a, you know, a crystal, and you can cleave it. I mean, it's a nice solid crystal. And this thing would curl up like a sheet of newspaper. It was so thin.
Oh my gosh.
It was that thin a crystal. So I gave a paper on that, and how you make very thin crystals as another aspect of my thesis. So that was the big technical problem, was getting the crystal thin enough.
Right.
And then I had to, all these very, very intentionally changes crystal structures three times as it gets into the ferroelectric state, and these happen at low temperature, so I had to develop, you know,
okay,
techniques for putting this thin crystal in, get it down to liquid nitrogen.
And then introducing that into the
spectrophotometer and getting everything lined up. So but it was, and it was just, and I'll never forget, I like, when I'm left to my own devices, sleep very late in the morning and work half the night. And I remember it was one Sunday night late, and the first time with this work, and this feeling of absolute elation. This is something that nobody in the world has ever seen before.
Right.
It's just that,
yeah,
feeling of scientific discovery is a real exciting thing.
And that was that the first time where you really felt it? Really felt that?
I had done a lot of, you know,
yeah,
research projects, but nothing was so completely new.
Mm.
And Smackula had took me aside once and said, Jay, you have to realize that the scientific research is 95% really tedious and frustrating. But that other 5% makes up for everything in spades. He's right. And
yeah.
Because, and I think it's especially true now with very elaborate things where there's 100 people working on an experiment, and you work and work and work, and everybody does a little part, and zap, there's the experiment. I was able to work by myself. I don't think I would have enjoyed the way that physics has gone these days with the big complex experiments, and you're playing a fairly minor role.
You were more suited to taking it from handling all aspects of the work yourself. Mm-hmm.
And I've never reacted very well to bosses telling me what to do.
Mm.
So I want to make up my own thoughts in mind about the way I do stuff. And solid-state physics is a lot better than other branches of physics. There still is a lot of work where an individual can do stuff.
Mm.
Although solid-state physics, I feel, in some respects, is the classical solid-state physics, at least, has sort of turned into a backwater.
Today?
Yeah.
Really?
You got the nano... Mm-hmm. Phenomenon, but I think like work on the solid state physics of semiconductors. Some of that work is not as quite as pioneering as it was. This is my observation. I haven't done much and thought much about that.
But at the time, it was extremely wide open.
Yes. Yeah. All of this stuff for the previous 20 years flowing out, all these unexplained phenomena, and because an awful lot of the work up to the time had been empirical.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And nobody knew why these things worked. And something like superconductivity at that time was, I remember reading the Dutch work on superconductivity, and they got into a philosophical discussion and said this is a problem that's beyond the human mind to figure out. But it was just an empirical thing, and all these crazy phenomena.
Right.
It took some pretty sophisticated quantum mechanics to get to the heart of it, and some reasoning that is not terribly obvious.
So it seems that what struck me is pretty soon after having finished your dissertation that you had an article based upon it published in the Physical Review.
Yeah.
Is that right? And that seems awfully fast to me. Was it a quick adaptation for you to,
Submit
the article, or
no? And I had written a report for the ONR on this, so I had it all written. I had my thesis written, and I put it into a report form, and it was just a matter of spending a day to, put it into their format. So
right.
It wasn't anything. But another thing I did it in my really before I got deeply into my research, I had passed my oral exams.
Mm-hmm.
After that, it's just putting in time. You know you're going to get done if you.
Right.
And I'm always struck by the number of people that did their thesis all but.
Yeah.
The research, and I said, well, that just because it takes an awful lot of just sticking to it. 26 years old and still doing all the stuff I'd been doing since I was in high school. It wasn't a very rewarding personal life. After I passed my oral exams, I saw that there was a fellowship for metallurgists to go to Sweden.
Hmm.
MIT was going to send a metallurgist to Sweden. And I went to John Wolfe, who's the head of the metallurgy department, and managed to persuade him that I said, you know, I have all this training, except I'm very weak in metallurgy, and this would be just a marvelous completion of my education to go to Sweden as a work in a metallographiska institute. I was persuasive enough that he picked me rather than one of his own students to go to Sweden for the summer.
And was it because of a passion for metallurgy or a passion to visit Sweden?
The passion. I could say it. This is the first time for my life for a break. I've been working steadily year after year after year, and here's a chance. I can relax a little bit for a summer.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that going to Sweden would be fun to do. And,
was it?
Oh, it was great. Yes,
yeah.
I never thought much about traveling outside the United States, and this was just came a bowl out of the blue. About 3 weeks after I got this thing, I was on my way to Sweden, and I was nervous. I didn't know any Swedish, so I got one of John Steinbeck's books on Cannery Row that translated into Sweden. And I would use that. I just read it in Swedish with the English translation there. So by the time I got there, I knew the name of all the Swedish fishes. It's the Swedish name for all the fishes, so I could order right off a Swedish menu, just flabbergasted my Swedish friends. So it was great. And the laboratory there closed down the month of July.
Hmm.
So I just just bummed around Europe for a month, and went to England and France and Switzerland and Germany. And I had had a German roommate my first year at MIT. There were three of us shared the room. The other guy was a New Zealander.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out the two of them had fought each other at the Battle of El Alamein.
Really?
And you talk about an interesting summer.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was just an amazing experience. This German had been a captain in the paratroopers and was one of these guys that they just drop him in for the first day of the battle and take him out and drop him again. And he was pretty badly injured. I didn't realize the whole summer that he couldn't use his left arm. But now he was back in Munich, so I visited him, and he was working at the Leica plant there.
Mm.
So I had a great summer traveling around and a great time in Sweden, and maintained close ties with Sweden ever since then.
Really?
Not in the last few years, but I've been back many times.
For just a pleasure?
No, this is when I was maybe at Amelco, setting up Swedish subsidiary, Swedish sales organizations, things like that.
Right.
Yeah, I had a nice social life in Sweden, so that helped. Made me very interested in going back there.
And as...
I think we're getting sort of off the
track. No, not at all. No. As your dissertation research was, as your graduate experience was coming to a close, you were realizing that you didn't want to stay in the Boston-Cambridge area, that the IBM situation was going to be a little bit too rigid for your taste. What were your ideas about where you wanted to go and what you wanted to do?
Well, this was an absolutely unbelievable time for jobs. I could have had my choice of 100 jobs without a question. So I could pick and choose, and I said, this is a chance. I went to GE, and I visited the Hanford plant, from a scientific point of view, it interested me the most because of the radiation damage on materials and how graphite turns into like a big meringue or something like that. And then I visited all the other GE plants. And of course, Bell Labs, which is the place that I would. There were a lot of MIT people there.
Right.
They were interested in me. And the work. I wasn't especially interested in transistors. I thought, well, that's. The basic work on that is done, and now it's just a matter of engineering. And but I would have worked for Ian Ross,
mm-hmm.
who went on to run the whole shebang there.
Right. And at that time, was he running the physics department?
No, he was running. It was a semiconductor oriented group.
Oh, right.
Jim Early was in that group.
Uh huh.
And then. Couple others, and I often wonder what my career would have been like if I'd gone there and I was right under the guy that ended up running it.
Yeah,
it's an interesting spectrum.